Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, I think this week we should give a shout out to the listener who has broken into triple digits.
It's amazing. There's a Facebook page, fan page for It's All Politics, and that number, which was at 38 just 24 hours ago.
A mere 24 hours ago.
Right. Has gone all the way to 39. No, it's actually gone to triple digits.
It's broken through the magic 100 barrier.
And you know who I thank for that? The Stupak Amendment.
I think it was the enormous national interest in the Stupak Amendment, which, of course, we've been talking about pretty much constantly on your blog, Political Junkie, and also in my column, Why You Watching?
Wait a minute. As soon as you mentioned that, the Facebook page went down to single digits. I can't believe you did that to us.
No, actually, my column is called The Other Guy.
The Stupak Amendment, by the way, just so we say, is the anti-abortion amendment that was added as a sop by House Speaker Nancy Pelosi to pro-life anti-abortion Democrats so they would come and make it easier for them to sign on to last Saturday's health care bill.
And 64 Democrats did join with every Republican, except one who voted present.
Do you know who that was?
Yes, it was John Shadegg of Arizona. And I actually know why he voted present.
Because he has a sense of...
There was a movement underway. There were a number of people on the pro-life side who were urging votes of present because they saw a chance that if they could defeat the Stupak Amendment as an amendment to the bill, then the bill would become unacceptable to all those pro-life Democrats who would then have to vote against the bill itself and kill the bill.
It's interesting that many Democrats have been put in the position of having to decide between abortion and health care. But there are a lot of Democrats, there's 64, and not just right-wingers, as you would think. I mean, Marcy Kaptur.
Oh, quite a few. There are lots of liberal Democrats
Catholics,
who are pro-life.
Right, exactly.
And as a matter of fact, who very much want to vote for the bill, and we're glad to have the opportunity to amend the bill to be friendly to their position on the abortion issue.
But there are many Democrats
who say, if that's still in it when it comes back from the Senate, we're voting no on final, that is to say, to clear the conference report and actually send it to the president.
Right. Diana DeGette, Democrat of Colorado, said if it comes back, a matter of fact, and Martha Coakley, the Senate candidate from Massachusetts, also said the same thing. Mm-hmm. If it comes back with that language, I am voting no. But what happened?
And they said they had 40 people on that position. And, of course, immediately the Stupak forces said, well, we've got at least 40.
We have 64 who voted for it.
64 who voted for it as an amendment, but we have 40 who would vote even against the conference report to kill the bill.
If it comes back without Stupak language. Either way, if Stupak is in the final language or it's out of the final language, the opposite side could very well threaten to withhold their votes. And given the fact that the House vote was 220 to 215...
Obviously, they can't withstand any large block of Democrats withholding their votes beyond the ones who already did. Let's talk a little bit about the ones who, even with this relatively conservative amendment, still thought that they could not vote for health care.
I suspect, though, that Nancy Pelosi may have given them a pass and said...
A few.
Well, it had three Democrats voted the other way, it would have gone down to defeat.
That's correct. And there were obviously 39 Democrats who still felt they had to vote against this bill. 31 of the 39 come from districts that voted for John McCain in 2008, and quite a number of them are in the South.
Freshmen?
About two dozen. Quite a number of them are freshmen. About two dozen of them are blue dogs, not coincidentally. So you've got a hardcore base there of people who are probably not going to come to the bill no matter what. And how many got passes? How many were told, well, you know, I know it's not too good for you in your district, but please give me your vote if we need it to get to 218. We don't know exactly what that number was. I'm guessing maybe half a dozen to a dozen were in that category. But they also got one other gift vote from Ann Cow, who goes by Joseph Cow, who is the Republican who represents a highly Democratic African-American district in New Orleans.
Louisiana's 2nd District, right? That had been held for a long time by Bill Jefferson, now behind bars.
Now a person with a number.
Soon to be behind bars. Mm-hmm. Gow said something very interesting. He said that, now remember, prior to the vote, Michael Steele said that if you're a Republican and you vote for this bill, we're going to go after you.
Right. And he will not go after Ann Cow.
No.
He will not go after the only Vietnamese member of Congress or Vietnamese-American member of Congress.
In history.
And he will not go after one of the very, very few people of color in the Republican Party. And the reason, of course, he won't is because there probably aren't a lot of other Republicans who want to even run for the Republican nomination in that district. They assume it's going back Democratic in 2010.
Unless the Democrats commit fratricide.
Or unless they nominate Bill Jefferson from his prison cell.
But I thought what Gow said was very interesting. He said, party means less to me than the needs of the people of my district, and that's why I voted for it. And it's overwhelmingly African-American. It's overwhelmingly poor. It's overwhelmingly people who suffer from lack of proper health care.
And one other thing that he said was he waited until the very end. And I was watching the vote, and he did. He waited until the very end, until they had 218 Democrats on the bill, before he then added his vote. He would have voted against the bill if that could have killed the bill. Mm. If he could have been the one last vote that sent it down, he would have cast that vote to do so.
But here's the stark fact. Nancy Pelosi could afford to lose 39 Democrats and have it passed. Harry Reid in the Senate cannot afford to lose one Democrat.
Well, he can't even afford to lose an independent.
Yeah.
And he's only got 58 Democrats to begin with because of a number of races that very narrowly went the Democrats' way in Montana and Virginia in 2006. And then, of course, the Al Franken in 2008, which they counted for months and months and months.
They're still counting, by the way.
Yeah, it's a matter. And so he's in a terrible position. He's got Democrats like Ben Nelson of Nebraska saying, I can't vote for any of that stuff that's in the House bill. And then he's got other Democrats like Roland Burris saying, if it doesn't have public option, if it doesn't have most of the things that are in the House bill, I'm not going to vote for it.
You have Joe Lieberman also complaining. You have Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas, who may have a very tough race next year. You have Mary Landrieu of Louisiana.
Who does have to, obviously, always worry about Louisiana.
Especially, which since Katrina has moved more and more Republican, more and more red. And then you also have, forget about any Republican vote. Once upon a time, we talked about Olympia Snowe, Susan Collins. That seems very unlikely in the way that Harry Reid will bring out this bill. So he has a margin of error of none.
And at this point, it's not even clear they're going to have the 60 votes they would need to proceed to formally consider the bill. Now, they can bring out the product of Reid and his inner circle that are putting together some kind of amalgam of the two Senate bills from the Health Committee and the Finance Committee. They can bring that out on the floor. They can read it. They've talked about actually literally spending hours reading the bill on the floor. They can even start to debate. But they cannot formally move to consider the bill until they have 60 votes to cut off what will doubtless be a Republican effort to block that procedural move.
Perhaps one of the reasons that Harry Reid has not brought it out yet is because, one, we don't know what it will cost, and Republicans will say that premiums will go up. This will not cut premiums as the Democrats and President Obama has been arguing from the beginning. So while the Republicans unanimously will fight this, the Democrats will have to get 60 votes just to start the debate. And that leads to the famous R question, and that is reconciliation.
Will they fall back on going to a procedure whereby this is all made part of the budget rules? And by using the budget rules and reconciliation, as it's called, they would not be subject to filibuster, and they would not need 60 votes to cut off
a
filibuster.
They would need 51.
If they had 51 votes, they could get it done. Now, there are all sorts of downsides to this. Number one, it would be considered an extraordinary procedure and an abuse of power, perhaps.
It would ruin the comity that the Republicans and Democrats have right now.
Yeah, and let me just parenthetically note here that
because you are a parent.
Since the Republicans have taken the tack practically from January on, in both the House and the Senate, that they're not going to provide any votes for anything. They're going to discipline their people to vote against everything to the last man and the last woman. They really don't have a lot of other things to threaten to do. If the Democrats should push their power to the maximum, if they should say, all right, we're going to use these other budget rules to get these huge bills done, obviously that's not what those budget rules are meant for. But if they do that just to get the bill through, what are the Republicans going to do? Are they going to walk out?
Well, no. The only leverage I think the Republicans have may not be on health care, may be on Afghanistan and foreign policy, but that's another question altogether.
It is altogether another question because there the Republicans are probably closer to the position of the president than the Democrats are. So it doesn't really help them to say we're not going to help you on Afghanistan. That would be inimical to their own policy preferences.
And apparently President Obama is perhaps weeks away. We're thinking maybe Thanksgiving. There are so many options on Afghanistan policy. There is the lowball numbers of 10,000 to 15,000 more troops.
Joe Biden's solution.
Joe Biden and the ambassador.
Yes, Carl Eikenberry, former general, former troop commander there in Afghanistan, now our ambassador there. It's been leaked now. Apparently for weeks has been advising the president in these innermost National Security Council meetings that sending more troops to Afghanistan, any more troops to Afghanistan, would be a mistake until they can straighten out the relationship with Hamid Karzai.
And that doesn't look like it's about to happen anyway, because what does Karzai have to lose? There's no way the president of the United States could say, look, if you don't shape up, if you don't get rid of the corruption, you don't get rid of the poppy growth, then we'll just withdraw. And he knows, Karzai knows, that we can't because Afghanistan is part of the bigger policy of Pakistan.
So here's a guy who has just gotten reelected for another five-year term in an election widely considered to have been hideously fraudulent, essentially having us over a barrel. Where is the point where it is possible for the American president to say, no, I'm not going to prop up your regime. I realize there will be negative consequences for us if your regime falls, but we're not going to do it anymore.
He won't do it because of Pakistan. But again, if Ambassador Eikenberry is the low number of the number of troops,
zero,
then you right, or 10,000 or whatever it is, then you have General McChrystal who's still talking about 40 to 45,000. And of course,
and apparently wanting more, but only feeling he could get away with asking.
And right
for
now,
40.
There's like, what, 65,000
68,
troops? 68,000 troops. You know, it's weird to have to watch this every day, but every day, like Gordon Brown said the other day, the British Prime Minister said that we expect a decision within days, and yet the White House says, no, it's not going to be within days. We're not expecting anything soon, probably not before Thanksgiving.
That's because the president has gone off to Asia right. on a long scheduled tour of major, major important economies that we are dealing with, China, Japan,
right?
Singapore,
right.
Korea. And he can't exactly turn around and say, no, look, hey, guys, you know what, I'm just a little too busy. He can continue to work on this decision. I'm sure he will. And I think, among other things, he'll talk to the Chinese and to some of these other Asian leaders about what they think about Afghanistan and what they could do to, in some sense or another, help the situation. I doubt very much any of them is going to be able to bail him out or offer him any advice, but he's going to ask.
I just don't remember a time in recent history where the internal decision-making of what to do, in this case Afghanistan, has been so played out in the public on the front pages of the newspapers. Even when Bush was deciding whether to go to war in Iraq.
They had already decided
exactly.
And they were trying to get support
That's
for
exactly
it.
Right.
It's a totally different
exactly.
story. They were out there talking about the warning should not be in the shape of a mushroom cloud. Their minds were made up.
Exactly. And the fact that this administration's minds have not been made up, I think, sends a little worrying signal to our allies and perhaps maybe even emboldening the opposition.
Oh, when you say the opposition, do you mean the Taliban in Afghanistan or what he's dealing with here in the United States, the opposition
Republicans.
Of the Republicans?
Right. Well, both of them actually will probably be emboldened by a seeming sense of indecision. One more thing about Congress before we forget. It was interesting that almost immediately after John Garamendi in California and Bill Owens in New York won those special elections on November 3rd, Nancy Pelosi had them sworn into Congress like
Thursday and Friday,
right,
and the vote was on Saturday.
Because they wanted the vote so much. But now it looks like there's a possibility that Bill Owens may not. Oh, I mean, I'm doing a little reach here, but there's a possibility that Bill Owens may not be the winner in New York 23.
That's right. On election night, they thought he had at least a lead of 5,000 votes with most of the votes counted.
93% was in, and Doug Hoffman conceded early.
And Doug Hoffman conceded in part because his home county had not come in as heavily for him as he expected. Well, it turns out they undercounted the vote.
They undercounted his vote.
In his home county, and he actually did better, and apparently the margin's down to something like 3,000, and they've got 10,000 absentee ballots coming in.
There were 10,200 absentee ballots sent out, and including...
They were sent out, not necessarily all coming.
But also remember, that in this district is Fort Drum, which is a military base. There's a lot of military absentee ballots, we think. Now, there are two ways of looking at it.
Bill Owens is a former captain in the Air Force.
Military personnel often vote Republican, so they could have been voting for Skazafava if they weren't following this big
whole
fight.
controversy, ideological battle.
And
if they didn't really know who she was or they just thought she was the candidate of the party.
But if these ballots were sent in toward like the end of October when Hoffman was gaining rapidly, a preponderance of the votes could come in on his behalf. So
yeah, the Hoffman people think they're going to gain. The question is, can they gain in whatever number of those 10,000 come back? And it clearly won't be 10,000. And it wouldn't be good if it came back at 12 or 15,000. But let's
say... Two words, Chicago.
Let's say 6 or 7,000 of these come back in. They're going to have to be heavily preponderantly Hoffman to actually reverse the result.
Right.
But it could happen.
It could happen. Now, the question might lead to some people saying, well, does Bill Owens vote on health care legislation? Does it get wiped out? No, it doesn't.
There was no dispute.
No,
the election
was
not in contest.
That's right. As Doug Hoffman conceded. Now, of course, a concession doesn't mean the election is over. A concession is just a nice way of saying... the better person won, and that's what usually a concession is. But I can concede an election and find out that the votes are still coming in for my behalf. And I win. Look, Al Gore conceded on the night of 2000.
And then came back and said, I withdraw my concession.
Exactly. So concession doesn't
mean
anything.
Hoffman has not withdrawn his concession exactly. What he has said, though, is that if he winds up the winner, he'll obviously make himself available to serve in the United States Congress. I suspect the Republicans would be willing to have him sworn in Bill Owens' place.
Exactly. But whatever votes Bill Owens has taken, regardless of what happens in the future, future recount or recanvassing, those votes stay. That doesn't change anything.
Now, meanwhile, Dede Scozzafava has lost her leadership position among the Republicans in the state assembly.
It's hard to be in the Republican leadership and endorsing the Democratic candidate for Congress.
Although Joe Lieberman kept his committee chairmanship in the United States Senate after endorsing John McCain for president.
Because they needed Joe Lieberman as a nominal Democrat because they needed to reach 60 votes. And interestingly enough, have 60, and we still don't know if the Democrats have
Joe Lieberman. The question is, what does a nominal Democrat mean?
Right, but Scozzafava's numbers in the state assembly in New York do not mean that much. But I suspect that she, you know, she's been on the Rachel Maddow show. She's been on a lot of shows decrying the Republican Party, saying that, you know, they're
not based on substance.
Exactly right. And,
et
cetera. And Democrats have been saying, look, you want to come to us? We welcome you with open arms.
And she may make the switch, although she has said she will not. And she likes to advertise the fact that she voted 95% of the time with the Republican leadership in the assembly in New York.
And that almost reminds me of Arlen Specter saying that, well, I'm not switching parties. I am staying Republican until he switched parties.
That's right. And you know who else switched parties this week?
Who's that?
Lou Dobbs.
Did he?
He left the CNN party. And now he's either going to join Fox, as some people believe, or he's going to have a party of his own.
The rumor I heard is he's replacing Ian Smith in Rhodesia.
Yes. Well, I know that job has been open for a while. Look, I mean, what is Lou Dobbs up to? I thought a couple of years ago when he came out with the book about what America needs or leading America or what America really is looking for in a great leader, the picture of Lou Dobbs that he was presenting at the time suggested to me that he was, you know, maybe he had done what he expected to do in cable television, and he was ready to move on to a larger stage.
Well, I understand that he's seriously thinking about building a fence to Pretoria in 1960.
I think what he's thinking about is he is thinking about making an independent run for president.
Wow.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
Wow. You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
Wow. And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
Wow.
Sometimes the world looks perfect. Nothing to rearrange. Sometimes you just get a feeling like you need some kind of change. No matter what.
Ken, this is just in our fan page on Facebook. It's All Politics, We're All Fans is now back down below triple digits.